Thank you, Shirley.
It struck me while I was listening to Shirley, one thing I'd like everybody to think about tonight, all these folks are from St. Louis, and they all have very different styles, and it's going to be a real treat to hear how everybody's different tonight. Now, the next person, of course, I never associated with St. Louis. I associate him with Wales, mainly because I go to his restaurant and bar, and I drink a lot of his Welsh ale. That's my probably most primary association when I think of John Dressel. I found out while looking him up that he was born in St. Louis and grew up in Granite City. And, hey, that's close to Wales, right? In spirit. What I did find out and what I knew already was that he's a nurturer of poetry in the St. Louis area. I knew that he wrote poetry. I knew that he had taught. And I found out when I got a letter from the St. Louis Poetry Center that he was having a reading at his bar and restaurant on August 9th, and they did a chapbook reading contest, and I think it's great that there are people in the St. Louis area that can support poetry in so many different ways. He went to Northwestern for his undergraduate work. He got his MA in English from Wash U, taught at Webster, of course. Now he's serving that fine Welsh ale, and his potato chips are very good, too. I'd definitely try them at least once or twice. And he has several books published. I'd like to welcome John Dressel and let you guys listen to his poetry.
My real reading glasses out here. Well, as has just been mentioned, I have more than a casual interest in the tavern business. And I thought I might start tonight by reading a little poem I wrote several years ago called Welcome to the Tavern. Those of you who know me know that I am, as I say, more than casually interested in the tavern business and side with Dr. Johnson in his opinion of the tavern. I'd like to read you that. It's something we all think we know, I think, and we're not, when you try to quote it, you never get it quite right, so I got down my Bartlett's familiar quotations from behind the bar before I came over here tonight. This is exactly what he said. There is nothing which has yet been contrived by man by which so much happiness is produced as by a good tavern or inn. And so, to me, Duff's was described earlier as a restaurant. To me, it's a tavern in the old and full sense of that word. The word tavern comes from the same Latin root as the word tabernacle. So they both, to me, have... It has a religious connotation, and as Dr. Johnson intimated, may indeed be a greater place of solace and refuge than its relation, the tabernacle. So this is a villanelle, which is a verse form perhaps too complicated to try to explain if you're going to try to read four poems in 10 or 12 minutes. But I'm sure most of you know what a villanelle is anyway. And there's a little literary reference in the second line, momentary stay, which of course refers to Robert Frost's definition of the poem as a momentary stay against confusion. There's an epigraph to it from Andrew Marvell. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, to their embrace. And I'd like to, dedicate it to Duff's and O'Connell's, both of which have celebrated their 15th anniversaries this year, Duff's last month and O'Connell's tomorrow. So... Welcome to this tavern, a fine and public place, to rest and talk in momentary stay, where food loves drink and life and art embrace. Signs of those who do not plead our case but celebrate it, deck these walls to say, welcome to this tavern, a fine and public place where music is to set the measured pace the heart must move to, resonant and gay, where food loves drink and life and art embrace. the grave old knowledge that we each must face a private end, these words will not allay. Yet welcome to this tavern, a fine and public place, where we go on at heart a cheerful race in spite of time, and glad to know the way that food loves drink, and life and art embrace. So rest and talk and savor what of grace is offered here, good friends, before you pay. Welcome to this tavern, a fine and public place, where food loves drink, and life and art embrace. I was raised a Presbyterian and lapsed at about the age of 18. And at about the age of 38, we had a couple of young children, and I'd realized that my Presbyterian Sunday school upbringing had provided me with an irrational but a nonetheless real kind of sense of an undergirding order to the world. And so I decided to try to give my children that experience and took them to the Second Presbyterian Church and enrolled them in the Sunday school. And they found out I was teaching at Webster College and asked me to teach a Sunday school class of junior high school kids, which was one of the more terrifying experiences of my life. And the only positive thing, one of the few positive things that came out of it, was a poem about Goliath. Because the kids, of all the things we tried to talk about and interest them in that 3 or 4 months we did that, the only story they really were interested in was the story of David and Goliath, because somehow that the big guy, the little guy, the underdog, good and evil, and so forth, that turned them on. And on top of that, I had an old family Bible that had some Renaissance prints in it showing David walking along carrying Goliath's big, bloody head. And the kids liked that. So I got to thinking about that story and about, well, you know, what about Goliath's point of view? There's more than one side to every story. As Faulkner said, you change the point of view in any story and you've got a different novel, you know. And David wasn't such a pristine character either when you think about it. He got his first wife, Saul's daughter, by going out and with his men and killing 100 Philistines and bringing back the bloody foreskins to purchase his first wife. And then, of course, when he fell in love with Bathsheba, why, she happened to be married to Uriah, and he arranged for the men to fall back in battle and leave Uriah exposed so that he was killed. So there are references to that later on in the poem. But the idea is that I'm kind of the MC, and I'm going to bring Goliath out and introduce him to you and let him, you know, I'm introducing him, in other words, let him kind of take his own bows, tell his own story. So it's called Let's Hear It for Goliath. Let's hear it for Goliath, who never asked to be born either, let alone grow 9 feet tall and wind up a metaphor. Fat chance he had of avoiding the shove from behind. His old man no doubt gave him a sword to teeth on, and a scout for the Philistine host probably had him under contract by the end of junior high. It was a fix. And who wouldn't have cursed at the sight of that arrogant runt with the sling, who, for all his psalms, would later buy one wife with 100 bloody peckerskins and another with a king's X on Uriah? Bah, let's hear it for Goliath, a big boy who got bad press but who did his job, absorbed a fluky shot, and died with a thud. This is a poem about something that happened when I was 13 years old, about which I kind of, it rummaged around in the back of my mind, the incident, for 37 years. And I used to tell my creative writing students at Webster that they say, what shall I write about, you know, particularly those who were doing short stories. I said, well, your subconscious has kind of sorted that out for you, I think. You look back. In this case, you're talking people 18 to 20 years old. Look back when you were 9 or 10, 11, and remember what happened, you know, and that's what somehow is significant to you. Maybe you don't know why yet, but in the process of writing about it, perhaps you'll discover. So, well, this happened to me in It was the winter of 1948, and I've titled the poem January 30, Wilson Park, Granite City, Illinois, January 31st, 1948, which was indeed a Saturday night. Now, I'm not sure it was the Saturday night, but I checked out the old calendar, and it was, so it'll do for the Saturday night. In Granite City, it's a steel milling town, of course, which is why my Welsh grandparents came there to work in the steel mills early in the century. And they used to, I don't know whether they still do or not, but they used to blow the big whistle, or the hooter, as they call it in Wales, on the steel mill every night at 9 o'clock, and everybody under 16 was supposed to get off the streets at that time. So there's a reference in it to the curfew. And another thing about Granite City, it's not like the Central West End. You don't have a lot of street lights. You just have them on the corners, so the town is dark, and you've got these little pockets of light on the corners. Well, this is about three 13-year-old boys just into puberty who go out on Saturday night, and we used to go out and peek in windows and go up and down the alleys and things and see what was about. And we saw this couple coming along and going into Wilson Park, and well, we thought, aha, they're going to go in there and make love, you know, and we're going to follow them and see what's, you know, what it's like, what's going on. So we, since the middle of January, it was very cold, and they probably were just taking a shortcut. But we didn't think so, and we followed them. And instead of finding that, we had perhaps our first encounter with the void. But it's called Wilson Park, Granite City, Illinois, January 31st, 1948. We watched from the cindered alley as the couple came out of the cold and the dark into the brief intercession of light at the corner, and passed in their whispering, arm in arm, into the mysterious winter thing that was the park. We were three boys, turned 13 and compelled to be curious, moved by what was stirring in our just pubescent loins, out to uncover what wonder we could on a Saturday night in the pocked and gritty town, before the steel mill whistle blew and sent its great face curfew like some hollow groan of earth ascending and diffusing towards the stars. We followed them, or what we took for them, one shadow moving, intermittently visible, down the entry path between the leafless trees, the somber clumps of shrub and evergreen, uncertain in the night. The path was hard and black beneath our feet. We crossed a small stone bridge that arched a frozen pond, and in the central garden's maze of rock and hedge, we lost them. No shadow made a move upon the field beyond. We stood there, silent, listening to the wind. Its moan was constant, clean, and cold. It was old. The distant entry light was dim. The curfew blew. We ran and ran. I suppose once that kind of experience happens to you, you keep running in a sense. But, this last poem I'm going to read is the most recent poem I've written. I wrote it in Wales when I was there in June. I'd been reading earlier in the spring a book called America B.C., which has to do with all of these stories of all of these other peoples from Europe and Egypt and outer space who supposedly came to this continent before Columbus. The B.C. stands for Before Columbus, by a professor at Harvard. And so I was thinking about that, and then there's a Welsh legend about a prince named Madoc who in the year 1176 allegedly sailed from North Wales westward into the Atlantic and came to America, and surprisingly didn't make landfall in the usual places in the Bahamas and whatever, but he managed to sail around Florida and up to the present-day site of Mobile, Alabama, and disembarked there, and with his men made his way up into Tennessee. And anyway, the legend goes eventually the Welsh intermarried with Indians, and they wound up in the Dakotas and became the Mandan tribe. And there's some scholarly you know, some historical scholars who think there's something to this. It certainly was a prevalent legend in the 19th century in America. Fenimore Cooper has his leather stocking character mention it in the novel The Prairie, for instance. The English got real interested in it in colonial times because even though these were the Welsh, not the English, who did this, why it was a prior claim against the French in terms of Louisiana. And the Welsh actually sent a man named John Evans out to kind of try to hunt this down, and he came to St. Louis in 1796. And the Spanish governor received him and wined him and dined him, gave him some land grants, and discouraged him from going out and looking for the Welsh Indians because, of course, the Spanish weren't interested in the Welsh, the verification of this tale, because it would have strengthened an English claim to the territory. Anyway, poor old John Evans became an alcoholic as a result of that and went down to New Orleans and drunk himself to death. But the Welsh in Britain occupy a position in the English imagination similar to that of the Indians in America, I think. They are the original people, the Brythonic Celts who were there before, and they're out there in the West, and somehow they have a greater and more mystic and mysterious, you know, connection with the land and all this. And so I got to thinking about, well, why not assume this is all true and try to put this tale of the Welsh Indians in the context of all these other people who were supposedly here, and then wonder why only the Welsh of all these people stayed on into the 19th century, which may have had something to do with their prior experience in Britain, not only with the English and the Normans, but with their own treacherous fellow tribesmen. So this is called Old Times in America, A Legend in Context. Let's go against the grain of scholarship and say it's all true. Let's say America before 1492 was a kind of secluded getaway spot for an in-crowd from all over, and not, as now is generally assumed, simply the western terminus for the horny Viking run. Let's say Phoenicians came to do a little business, and Egyptians parted from the Red Sea and high and dry of Moses, glad to find a place not yet passed over by Jehovah. Let's have Gaels in New England, building stony cellars for arcane druidic reasons, which would later come in handy for the Puritans to store roots in. Let's say that stellar fellows came from outer space to pose for Aztec stone carvers and give them the lowdown on how to make calendars, and throw in for good measure those meandering Welshmen who somehow managed to sail around Florida without colliding with a single little island, let alone Cuba, and finally hit the beach on the present-day site of Mobile, Alabama. It was no mean feat of navigation, brother. It almost makes you want to whistle Dixie. Anyway, let's buy the lot. Let's say the old continent was a swinging place in those days, that the Indians made a killing out of holiday wigwams, and the boys from the other galaxy wooed and wowed the maids with their phasers. Let's do it. And wonder why only the Welsh stayed on when all the rest went home, unfurling sails or blasting off in saucers, leaving no burial trace behind them. Let's say perhaps the Welsh, free of all that feudal mess in Britain, shut of Norman brigands and their own sly kin, decided home was where you hung your moccasins, that Indian ways and mates came good as any, and the bison was a blessing as the beast in charge. Let's say they took their fair hair to Dakota country, where it flourished in the Mandan until 1838, when fate or some vile agent slipped the tribe infected blankets and thus wrote Finis to them with a pox. It's not our most sad story, even if it's true. At least they may have had a fling before the land got staked and owned, and having come from history which the Indian yet would know, have felt the great plain freedom of a gift of second earth. Let's say that's the best face to put on it anyhow, the most consolation the tale has to bear. Thank you.